Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 120 of Registry Matters. Larry, I think we should set up some sort of plan where we should record from the super secret underground bunker so that we could like sit across the table from each other and, I don't know, we could like pass the virus back and forth to each other.
Well, it's not easy to get there to the super secret bunker because transportation has been curtailed and requests for less movement have been made. So it's going to be difficult, isn't it?
Are we practicing social distancing properly then?
I'm doing my best, but I was forced to get out today because some nut wanted to record the podcast and he didn't want to use the telephone.
Never. I never, ever want to use the telephone. Actually, you know, on that, since you bring that up, many, many, many podcasts that I do listen to where they do have some kind of studio where they have, you know, a table set up and they have multiple microphones around the table, they're all recording from home. NPR's doing it. Vox is doing it. All kinds of different places. I'm recording from my closet and, you know, because they have all kinds of clothes in there to help deaden the sound and whatnot. There is a massive disruption of our world going on right now. It is unprecedented. It is crazy.
It is indeed. I've been around for well over 100 years now, and I've not seen anything that compares.
And not only that, so I was just entering into the criminal justice system when the last one happened in around 08. And it's like that was happening fast, you know, 600,000, 300, 400, 500,000 jobs per month. This is happening at an astonishing rate that even like a daily podcast is not fast enough for you to get any sort of updates. Jobs Friday that comes out a month late, that data is going to be blown out of proportion by the time we actually get the numbers.
You are correct. This is a fast moving, exceptionally fast moving situation. It's unfolding faster than I'm a tad bit on the inside in terms of the governor being that I work with a senator. The governor is communicating daily by various means to the state legislators, and there's an update daily. And what was put out yesterday is no longer relevant.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And you can share with me what you follow, like something of some unemployment claims, and it was in like the hundreds, and it's not in the hundreds this going round.
That would be at the state level here. That was released on the news, and weekly unemployment claims for our state had gone down to less than 1,000 a week. So the previous week, where there was a full week of unemployment data, there was around 800 claims, and so far through yesterday, there's been 11,000 claims in this state alone. So if you extrapolate the national average where we've been in the 250,000 to 300,000 weekly claims for initial claims for unemployment, not ongoing, but the initial claims being filed, that if you do a 10-12-fold increase on that, you're going to see a couple million to 3 million claims on the next weekly data that assembles the entire nation's unemployment claims, initial claims together.
I think I saw something posted on Twitter. It's around 200,000 nationwide, I think, is some sort of rough average for the number of unemployment claims.
250,000 to 300,000.
And so now it's going to be something of 3 million in the next go around. And that's even a lagging indicator because that's probably 10-ish or 2 weeks old, 10 days old, something like that.
Well, it would be people who have been told that you're being furloughed in the previous week. And so it's going to, I would say it's going to probably escalate from there because more and more people being furloughed as more and more businesses are being asked or required to shut down or to severely restrict their operations. I don't know many businesses that have deep enough pockets that take a 50% reduction in sales that are going to be able to keep the same staffing for an indefinite period of time. You might do it for a week or two to be generous and to be socially responsible, but very few businesses have the additional staying power to do that for a long period of time. So these people, once they get their final paycheck or they go on severely reduced hours, they're going to put in claims for initial claims for unemployment.
What about the government's role? I mean, this is important to me in regards to the registrant population in general, that we are already a struggling group of people to get jobs, et cetera. et cetera. Excuse me, Brenda. I needed to say et cetera, not et cetera. And this is obviously going to put a ton of pressure on the entire population of all of the people that call themselves humans, let alone anybody that has these extra little markers against them trying to get a job. This is going to be huge. What do you think about, there's like this $1 trillion package going through at the federal level to try and start dumping cash into people's pockets to pay rent, car notes. This is insane.
Well, the $1 trillion is just a drop in the bucket. If you're talking about our economy, something on the $23 to $26 trillion, I mean, I don't keep track of the exact numbers, but the national economy. So if you shrink the economy by, the experts are saying at least 10 to 12% in the second quarter. If you take that much economic activity out, you're talking about 2 to 3 times the stimulus that they're talking about. So that my opinion is that if the experts are right, that this is just the beginning of many stimulus packages that will have to be done, unless we believe in laissez-faire, that the system will correct itself and the strong will survive, and that will weed out excesses in the economy, and everything will just work itself out. And some people fervently believe that. There were people in the last major downturn who stood in the way of stimulus because they said that the government was picking winners and losers and the economy would self-correct.
There is probably truth in that, Larry, but I don't know that it's the humane way. I mean, like, we would want, let's just say tomorrow, this thing's over, a vaccine comes out, we can just blanket carpet bomb the entire United States with vaccines tomorrow, and it goes away instantly. We would want the economy to go back to normal immediately. But if the local subway has shut down, well, then how long does it take for the next subway to rise back up? What does it take for the next attorney's office or the local car repair shop? It would take an incredible amount of time to rebuild all of that infrastructure to be able to support all of the claims. And I mean, all of the demand is not, I don't mean claims, but all of the demand from the consumers.
Well, that was the point I was going to make, is that if you allowed this to seek its own resolution, you would have an enormous destruction of wealth. And we're having that now, but I'm talking about an enormous destruction of wealth that would go beyond. Right now, the people that are suffering the biggest losses have occurred on Wall Street. And the population, although more people invested in equities now than what they were, in past decades, there's still a lot of resentment for those people can afford it. So if they've lost a third of their market value, who cares? But the cascading effect from the economic shutdown is going to be that people won't be able to pay their basic expenses, like their car payments and their mortgages and basic expenses. So then you have the cascading effect of the foreclosures and the boarded up houses and the blighted communities and a yard full of repossessed vehicles that no one wants. And the economy would continue to shrink. And that's kind of like if you go into a nosedive in an airplane, it's hard to pull out of. As the economy is shrinking and there's no stimulus, nothing that's generating demand, the economy will continue to shrink until, well, who knows what point that things will begin to rebound. But yes, if you're totally indifferent to having millions of people's homes foreclosed, millions of people's cars repossessed, if that means nothing to you as a society, then you could just sit back and watch it fix itself. You'd probably have a lot of people that would suffer untold hardship, medical hardship. And when you put people on the street, their health goes down dramatically. Wouldn't you agree with that?
I would think so.
So if we all of a sudden have millions of homeless people rather than hundreds of thousands we already have, our public health is going to decline. Our life expectancy is going to decline. It's not going to be a country that you're going to be very impressed with living in. So what we have to do in this country is we have to do something that we claim that we're against. We have to rely on big government. And this is the time to play the clip.
I will play the clip. This is from, you'll know who it is.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
And who is that for those that don't know?
I don't remember exactly what day and time he made that, but I believe it was in the campaign of 1980, but it could have been in the campaign of 76. That was Ronald Reagan. That government was always portrayed as the villain and the problem. But the government is all of us collectively what few of us can do, and almost I'd say no one can do individually. I don't even think Warren Buffett can provide his own national security apparatus and his own Centers for Disease Control. And I don't think he can do all the things that government does. Government is nothing more than what we in a democratic society agree that we're going to do for one another. That's all government is. It's what we want it to be. And government has the power to borrow against future prosperity in this country. We can go into debt. This is the reason why you should balance your budget and you should run surpluses like we should have been doing the last 3 years when we were digging ourselves even deeper into debt, because we had the frivolous tax cut that we had that blew a hole and we also increased spending. Now we justifiably need to increase spending and we need to run a deficit, and we're starting out at $1 trillion baseline deficit already.
And the Fed, can you explain this to me? I don't quite understand necessarily. I sort of just on a scratch of the surface about him reducing the rate to something close to zero. Can you explain that a little bit?
Explain what about, you talking about the interest rate cut?
Correct. And what does that mean, and why, like, you know, there's no more tools that they have necessarily, like they're out of options. So now we have to go to legislative measures to try and fix this, that the Fed can't do anything to manipulate the economy.
Well, it's the rate that the banks borrow from the Fed, and banks need liquidity. People don't understand that if a bank merely hoarded the cash that you put in, they wouldn't be able to pay for their bricks and mortar, for their personnel, for the health cost, and they wouldn't be able to have profits for their shareholders. So they have to invest the money, and a financial institution's profits are the difference between the cost of funds. Because cost of funds, there's generally cost. Funds are not free. There's a cost of funds. For example, if you have deposit accounts, if you look at a bank's balance sheet, you'll see the average cost of funds, and cost of funds will be staggered between no interest accounts all the way to certificates of deposits that yield different amount. But the average cost of funds, and then there's also what they borrow from the Fed, and the Fed has the ability to manipulate that funds rate and bring it all the way down to zero, which they've done, which will help the banks expand. The cost of funds will be lower, but then the average yield on earning assets is the money that they lend. If you look at lending, of course, is going to contract. Now, all except for mortgage refis. If people are lucky enough to hold on to their jobs, they're going to be in a wonderful position to go out if you've either initiated a loan in the last 3 years or done a refi in the last 2 or 3 years when rates were creeping up, you may want to consider a refi now if you're strong enough financially to do that. It's going to be a benefit. But that is all the Fed has to do. I don't know that we can take rates below zero. I don't know that the Fed's going to start paying banks to borrow from them. But that would be the next step. If you want to inject more liquidity, but when the Fed takes that rate to zero, they're trying to make sure that there's plenty of liquidity available for redemption of deposits and for lending. You're hoping that the lower interest rates will generate this activity that we so need, because if people can't borrow, like when the system seized up in 2008, you couldn't borrow no matter how well. Your credit history was paying. I mean, the system completely seized up. There was no liquidity, and that's when these unprecedented steps were initiated. And they're merely replaying the 2008-2009 playbook that happened under Secretary Paulson, and then under Secretary Geithner, who followed after the Bush administration left.
Unbelievable. Let's see here. That was pretty much my questions that I had to you, talking about the economy and shutting down. I want to throw something at you that some terms have been flying around, but I want to specifically focus on the how people use terms to identify people that could lead to violence. And the term has been running around lately of the Chinese virus. And there's an uptick in violence towards the people that may look like they hail from that part of the world. And really what I'm trying to do is make a comparison to using a term like sex offender. And that spawns people to just go, ew, we hate you, even though your crime almost didn't even involve anything that was like a sex crime to begin with. Anyway, so I posted some articles in there of them that there's an increase in violence against the Chinese looking folks versus the idea that when you use the term sex offender, well, you know, we've covered articles where people have violence towards them just because the term sex offender.
The articles that I didn't catch the statistics of the increased violence on the articles, but it would be tragic if someone is holding individually a person of Chinese descent responsible. First of all, this reference to Chinese and to Wuhan flu, and this has been around for a long time, and I haven't heard all the criticism until I heard Donald Trump say it, and then all of a sudden it's become very racist. Now, granted, he has a slightly bigger microphone and slightly more exposure than if someone of a lesser standing says it, but I don't think that he should be saddled with inventing the term, being the first to use it. But if someone's going to, I just don't know what the average Chinese would have to do with how this was handled, and maybe we should refer to the Spanish flu of 1918 as the American flu.
Or the Kansas my research, flu,
right? Yeah, since my research indicates that it probably originated in a military facility in Kansas and got spread around the rest of the world, so we should call that the American flu, and people should be mad at the Americans, and they should have been committing violent acts against us.
I think
it would be sad. It would be terribly sad.
And what my understanding is that's why they're calling it coronavirus or COVID-19, is to keep it from being located to a group of people like we have with so many other things, like the Spanish flu and all that. But anywho, I just thought I wanted your take on the idea of how words matter, how terms matter, and in this particular case, it seems.
I agree with you. I mean, if we didn't have the label sex offender prior to us having a sex offender registry, you didn't ever hear of violence against them as a group. Now, prior to the registry, I hate to break it to you, people who did find the accusations of sexual offenses against a particular individual, they did what they do now to those in the registry. People got beat up because jails didn't just start becoming sensitive to sexual offenders. If you go back decades and decades and decades, the people who, before we had a registry, who had that jacket on them, as convicts refer to it, they were not very well approved of it. And so this is not new, but the widespread stuff that happens to people on the registry in terms of discrimination and in terms of random violence clearly wouldn't happen if we didn't have the label and we didn't have the registry. There's no doubt about it.
Gotcha. Got you. Let's start covering some articles. The first one comes from The Intercept. This is on the heels, I guess, maybe it was last week or a couple of weeks ago, that we were talking about the number of people that vote that are either felons or even the notion that you can vote while you are being detained. And this comes from Arizona jails. It says only 8 people voted from Arizona jails in 2018. Well, this election be different. And we had talked about that if you are detained, so you're speeding, whatever, and you get arrested the day of that you're supposed to be elected, that there's supposed to be accommodations for you while you're there. Possibly you change your address to get a ballot, but maybe the ballot can't make it to the mailroom. But like, this is apparently not really very many people when they go to jail are all that concerned about voting. They don't care or they can't. It's a couple of different layers of things in there. I just wanted to cover it to kind of follow up on something we've covered recently.
Well, the person who tried to vote, I mean, it would be if you asked to vote in jail, they'd look at you like you, I mean, there was something wrong with you.
Third eyeball out of the center of your head.
Yeah, but way back in 1974, the U.S. Supreme Court said, if you haven't been convicted, you have the right to vote. They affirmed that right. So it's been decades and decades that you have the right to vote in pretrial. But it's one of those rights that, how do you enforce it? You're in custody. And you tell the jailer, bring me a ballot, huh?
Yeah, a what?
Bring me a ballot.
For what?
today's election day. I'd like to vote.
F you, you're in prison.
That's exactly what they would tell you. And you would say, well, based on the U.S. Supreme Court in 74, I have the right to vote. They'd say, huh?
Yeah, they'd say the U.S. Supreme what?
And so this will only change when we as a society decide that people who are pretrial in custody deserve to be treated differently because they're not being punished. They're only being held on suspicion of a crime, unproven allegations, and that we need to treat them differently, which I have preached for years. I think that to the extent all possible, we should have different housing for people who are pretrial, different privileges for people who are pretrial, because they are only there awaiting an adjudication of the allegations. They're not there as a convicted person. And we don't get to deprive you of all your rights when you're unconvicted.
Obviously, this isn't anything that happens as far as people trying to vote. It doesn't, I mean, eight people, Arizona's not the biggest of states, but it's not a nothing state either.
That's how many people succeeded. We don't know how many people tried, do we? The article didn't cover that.
I totally agree with you. If out of Arizona, which I'm just going to throw out there, population of 5-ish million, maybe something like that, and eight mm-hmm. people pulled it off, there's probably a lot of people that aren't able to do it across the United States if they're even trying.
I would say the overwhelming majority, jails range in size from very, very small lockups to some very large urban high-rise facilities. You got the sprawling Los Angeles County jail system. You got the sprawling system in Cook County, Chicago. But most, they're not set up for it.
I mean, we do elections every 2 years and then with some additional ones.
I know, but when you're running a sheriff's office and you're trying to keep your county covered with deputies and you're trying to provide court security, and you're trying to run a jail, and you're trying to do it staff three shifts a day, and you're trying to buy supplies for your jail, and all the things that a sheriff is responsible for, trying to figure out how to figure out if anybody's in your jail has to vote, might be there on election day, and trying to set up a provision for that is just not the highest of priorities. Now, you can go out and run for sheriff and try that as a campaign. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. If you elect me, I'm going to make sure anybody that's in my custody is going to be able to vote when there's election comes under my command and find out how well that plays out with the constituents.
Perhaps we shouldn't lock nearly as many people up so they could focus on some other things that are related to your civil liberty, through your actual constitutional rights, maybe.
Now, before I get any hate mail, I believe that you should be able to vote. I'm just saying the practicality for the average sheriff is just not in, that's not in their daily routine to think about preparing for elections. They're preparing for a whole lot of things, and elections is not one of them.
All right, then. Well, let's move over to Medium. I don't know that we've ever covered Medium. Medium is a platform for people to write. It's sort of like a unified place for authors to post articles, I guess you could say. But this article is titled, Judges Can Protect Vulnerable Prisoners by Rethinking Jail Sentences, but only during the coronavirus pandemic. I guess the sentence we were just covering on the last article, we could reduce the number of people in prison so they could possibly vote. But this one is, don't put people in vulnerable populations that could bring the virus in. God, can you imagine? There are plenty of movies out there, Larry. I'm sure you haven't seen any of the movies. Oh, what are they called? Resident Evil is almost like this. You have some sort of crazy outbreak and everybody turns into a monster of some sort. And then they're just confined in a small space. And then obviously everything goes to crap and everybody's infected with the virus. We should not put everybody in prison or jail this go around.
Well, this would be a good opportunity for us to rethink our correctional systems when we have something like a pandemic, because I have no doubt that we're going to start hearing reports of facilities, and when it spreads, this is going to teach us that you just really can't. I mean, just to try to think about it, pretend you've got a 1,000 bed slots and you've got 24 housing units and you're trying to do the best you can, and you have one person get infected. Well, okay, you've got three isolation cells at sick bay that are, then when the second person gets infected, and then your three sick bay cells, then you have to turn a housing unit into it. So then all of a sudden, a 24 person or a 48 person housing unit, it can only house the three people that are sick. So you just took 40 something beds out of service. And it's a logistical nightmare for these people to try to figure out how to manage. And of course, then even when you do that, it's still going to spread, because those people have to eat. They have to have some basic human care. And unless you release them and sequester them at home, there's people in the facility that are going to come into contact with them. And so it's a logistical nightmare. And I don't know how they're going to deal with it, because it just seems like a matter of time that we're going to have outbreaks.
Jen in chat says 21 inmates at Rikers Island have been tested. 21 have tested positive for it. And I have no way to confirm that. And we know that that's coming.
And what's the capacity? I mean, Rikers is huge, but what kind of population are we talking about in Rikers?
you get to keep talking. I'll find it.
Okay. So, but yes, this article is judges can do their part. There is no silver bullet. If we cut the jail population by 50%, we're still going to have problems. They're more manageable because if you have more living units available, it's more easily able to isolate the people in that unit, and then you put in the most strict protocols in terms of contact with the people in those units. But if you have them jam-packed like sardines, you don't have the flexibility to put people in isolated and in housing units where they're at least with infected people while they're being quarantined. It's a logistical nightmare for jail administrators. I'd hate to be running a facility right now.
It looks like it has a daily population of 10,000 inmates. Holy crap, that's a lot of people.
That's the city of Covington.
That is
Georgia, crazy? That is. Oh, not Kentucky.
I can't even comprehend like that many people, and they're all, you know, they're in housing units that, you know, probably have something of 50, 80 people in them, and certainly not practicing the 6-foot minimum distance, and they're not washing their hands that often.
We're also talking about an extremely old facility.
Right. Yeah, sure. When was it built? I'm looking at the Wikipedia page. I know I can't use Wikipedia for any sort of reliable source of information. I know. Established 1932.
Yeah, we're talking about old, not state-of-the-art by any means.
So there's still officers walking around with like keys, and they're like pulling big long levers to open doors like you would see in the movie The Green Mile?
Yep. That would still be happening, I'm sure. I don't know how much retrofitting. I've never had the pleasure of being at Rikers, but I've had the pleasure of encountering people that have, and it's not a fun place to be.
I can't even imagine. Well, over at The Appeal, coronavirus leaves defense attorneys torn between visiting their jailed clients and spreading the illness. In the article, they're talking kind of like an abstract about an attorney who's got a client who needs to be represented. And he needs to go see the guy for some level of emotional support to show, hey, like, we're working on this and we're fighting for you. But at the same time, hey, we need details. We need to talk about the various elements of the crime, of the trial. And he's like, I don't want to go and infect him, potentially, if I've got it. I don't want to be infected. I don't want to infect the whole population in general. So the attorney goes, I should probably not go visit my client.
Well, and I have the answer for it, but a lot of attorneys are going to be too weak-kneed to do it.
What's that?
The answer is very simple, and usually they're not simple answers. But when you bring your client to court, you're supposed to represent to the court that you have thoroughly evaluated all the available defenses, you've thoroughly looked at the discovery, you've examined the elements of the crime and what the burden of proof would be, and you've discussed all of these with your client, and they understand the elements that need to be proven, the burden of proof, and they've looked at all the evidence that the state would be, or the prosecution, it could be the federal government, but all what the prosecution is going to be aligning against them, and that it's in the best interest of this individual to take this plea. And if you haven't been able to convert your client, it's very simple. Your Honor, I don't believe this case is ready for plea. I have not been able to adequately confer and apprise and evaluate this with my client, so therefore this case cannot be pled out. That's your answer.
But that means your client stays inside.
That's the unfortunate reality of that, where we have to decide if some of these people who are awaiting disposition of their cases, maybe we need to examine, as others have called for, letting people out right now, pretrial. We have a variety of technological tools which usually make your heart palpitate, and we could use these tools rather than put them on everybody willy-nilly. Because we have them, maybe we could use some of these monitoring apparatuses we have for people who are just simply unable to post their bond pretrial, and we could use the technology in a more positive way, possibly.
Now you've spoiled it for us going to the next article, actually. The next article is actually from The Appeal, talking about prosecutors across the U.S. call for action to mitigate spread of coronavirus in jails and prisons, one of which is if Larry Krasner, our favorite DA from Philadelphia, is talking about if you have anything of a misdemeanor and at least nonviolent felonies, just send them home, charge them later, drop charges, something along those lines, because you don't want to infect the entire prison population with you people. Yes, I said you people.
We can't have that.
We only have a handful of these Larry Krasners in the country. What about, like, why does it take a pandemic for people to get on board with going, oh, maybe having a virus spreading across the jail? Like, somehow that's crossed the line. Again, I said this last week. I don't want to minimize the 3-ish%. You know, I'm sure we're going to get different numbers on how fatal that this thing is. And one is more than zero, and that's too many. I'm not trying to go down that path. But if that is going to be the threshold of having this virus and infecting the people, and that's just some tragedy, why couldn't we have done this before, not using this as the catalyst that gets us there?
That's another easy answer, because we didn't need to.
So we have the boogeyman. So we put the boogeyman behind the walls, but now we have a bigger boogeyman. So now it's inhumane to keep the people, the other boogeyman behind the walls.
Well, one of the articles says it's not inhumane, but in this case, I believe that putting people in, I've done a complete about face just in the last week myself on this. I was carrying on life as usual through last weekend. I spent some time Sunday morning watching the programs, listening to Dr. Fauci, listening to the local expert. We have a doctor whose name's escaping me with my weak memory. But I started paying attention to what's being said, and I said, my goodness, I'm also putting people at risk, and I'm at risk myself. And these are unprecedented times, and putting people in lockup, they really can't even take any precautions. There's really very little you can do. You're totally at the mercy of others. What control do you have in a correctional setting?
Slightly above zero.
That is all you, I mean, many people who are incarcerated even have difficulty, I spoke about it last week, in terms of adequate running water and hand sanitizer. And of course, they don't control their laundry. They don't control the access to cleaning supplies for the housing unit. And this is a disaster, a recipe for a disaster. And you're sentenced, and if you're not even sentenced, if you're being held pretrial, you're being held pretrial because in most cases, your cash bond is higher than what you can afford to pay.
So we should potentially consider this as a way to, I don't even want to say it that way. This is a mechanism to get an idea of not putting these people into a hot zone. What's the right word here? I mean, like putting people into the lockup, putting people into the prisons where this could run rampant and then they have no control to help themselves. Does this finally bring to light an idea that our criminal justice system is just over the top? Is this what it took to get us there? And does it sustain after this goes away? Do we go back to locking everybody up for felony jaywalking?
Well, that's of course, there's no felony jaywalking, but I know your point. We typically have a brief epiphany, and whether it has staying power is yet to be seen. If we take these dramatic measures and there's not a huge spike in crime, now there will be some incident that will be traced directly to someone who's released. It's only a given. If you release thousands and thousands of people, someone, because we're human, is going to mess up. I mean, there's no way around that. And I always get tickled when they say, well, someone on parole, now they screwed up. Well, yes, they are on parole. They're being test driven to see if they can make it in the regular world. And of course, we won't have 100% success rate. But if we don't parole anyone, we'll never know what the success rate, whether it can be 60 or 70 or 80 or 90 or whatever the success rate can be if we don't parole anyone. Well, if we take no measures to mitigate this looming disaster, we're going to have people either sick or die as a result of our inaction. If we take these actions, there will be some saber-toothed tiger that will arise, and the conservatives will jump all over it, particularly if it happens in a liberal city like Philadelphia. They will say, see, this is your catch and release. This is what happens when you turn people out of prison and there's no accountability. That's what's, I mean, you might as well, we'll put this down to cover before the next 6 weeks are up. There'll be somebody who will mess up.
It seems inevitable. Seems inevitable.
Well, statistically, of course it is.
Of course it is. I know it. Over at the Inforum, I don't know what this one is called, Inforum.com, this article is the opposite of something we covered recently, where the sheriff was saying that we need to get the folks educated on the actual laws of how the registry stuff works. And this one says, do sex offender boundary laws work? And I want to say it's the sheriff of this town is saying that he almost like doesn't care what the evidence says. He wants the residency presence restriction stuff in place regardless, and he doesn't be damned what the science and evidence says.
Well, I'm going to have a little fun with this one because, believe it or not, I read it.
Oh, I did too.
And what I found is telling in here is that the person that they quoted, the sex offender, I forget his name. I'm having trouble getting this to open for me now, but he's a tier three in North Dakota, I believe it is. This is Fargo, North Dakota, right?
Yes.
Are we talking about the same article?
Okay. I believe so, yes.
So, yeah. So he's a tier three. Now, this is an educational moment for our thousands of listeners. He's a tier three lifetime only because he has more than one conviction. And his more than one conviction is for indecent exposure. And indecent exposure is showing your junk.
Right.
And he's a tier three. But now the irony of this is indecent exposure is not required by those tough federal standards to even be a sex offense that triggers a duty to register, which means we've got a person who's on the registry in North Dakota for life that North Dakota has decided he needs to have this label as a tier three. The big old bad federal government didn't do this to him, because the big old bad federal government doesn't even require that this offense trigger a duty to register. But yet he's a level three sex offender, and he's potentially facing this restriction. Now, it looks like they're grandfathering the people that are there on the 1,200 feet within Fargo's schools and parks. But everybody who blames the federal government, Adam Walshak didn't do this. Adam Walshak doesn't require indecent exposure, even be a sex offense.
I'm trying to find the section in the article where he talks about outside organizations trying to create problems with their local setup. I can't remember where it was. I just had it a minute ago. Did you see that?
I don't recall that part. Are you smoking that wacky weed again?
I think it's this one. Yeah, it says Pipecorn is maybe the guy's name. Says he thinks that some research have an agenda to support rights for sex offenders. And he said he's been getting most of his negative feedback from out-of-state groups. That's got to be you people, Larry.
That's probably he's talking about these Warren, Narsil, and Axel, these outside agitators. And that's what they do when they don't have anything else to argue. When they can't argue the facts, they scare people about outsiders. We don't have any problems here except for the outside agitators coming in and stirring up problems.
I have to play a quick little clip.
Now, I don't have to tell you who gets hurt first when this sort of thing happens, do I? Your people do. I know that. You know that.
Someone in chat asked if I could figure out a way to get Ross Perot into the podcast tonight.
Oh, well, you did.
I did. But yeah, that was one of the things that I was looking for, was that particular thing. That has to be the Narsals and the Wars and the Axals and so forth.
So that was who it would be. And that's the same thing that's going on in Georgia. These outside groups are coming in and interfering with. We didn't have no complaints in Butts County. Not a single sex offender complained about the signs until these agitators came in.
Maybe you people should stop.
Well, there's some who say we should, even on our side.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
How about, I've seen this going around too. The next thing is coming from Nebraska. God, I can't even speak. Nebraska Unafraid. I did skip an article there. I saw you clicking around earlier. Sheriff says registered people should disregard COVID-19 advice. I have heard it going both ways. Figuring out ways. I think I have this like towards the end of the podcast. Maybe I did move this article back there. Anyway, so this one says that the sheriff says that, no, be damned. Like, you need to come in and do your registration, come into the office. But other places are saying, maybe you should, maybe they're suspending all of the registration stuff, things like that.
Well, this will give me a chance to do a little pontification. We can do a little question and answer back and forth with it. And maybe some people in chat. I understand the fear of registry violations. The penalties are very significant in some states, and there's mandatory. Some states like Oklahoma, there's a mandatory, you will go to prison because the legislature has mandated that there's no suspended sentence. In my state, there is no mandatory jail time. There's a potential for a 4-3 felony, which carries a maximum of 18 months. But most of the time, probation is what a person's going to get here. So I understand, completely understand your fear, because they're sitting down with stopwatches in some of these law enforcement agencies. And now I got to clarify, they don't sit with a stopwatch in the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and they don't do it in Houston County, Georgia. But in other places around the country, they actually sit with a stopwatch waiting for the person's 90-day or 30-day interval, or in the case of a homeless, it may be a weekly interval to pass, so that they can write up a complaint and seek an arrest warrant. So your fear is completely reasonable, rational, and justified. But then we have to balance that with the reality of what it takes in most states to convict a person. In order to secure a conviction, you have to have a willing prosecutor. I grant you, you might find a willing law enforcement agent. I'm not saying that there are going to be thousands of them, but you might find a willing law enforcement agency. But the law enforcement, the deputy or the police officer is not allowed to bring the prosecution. They're not attorneys. So they need the office of the state prosecutor, the state district attorney, the county attorney, some prosecutorial authority. And it's very unlikely that you're going to get a prosecuting agency who's going to jump on board with that prosecution, knowing that the defense attorney, if they're allowed to see their client, of course, is going to say, well, it was in the middle of a pandemic with a public health proclamation of stay home, don't go out unless you have to. And there would be hundreds and maybe thousands of articles, certainly dozens in your state locale where your local officials have told you to stay home unless it's an emergency, unless you really need to go out. I just don't see a prosecution as being a viable option. A conviction, then you'd have to overcome citizens. Even the citizens are going to be hesitant to convict a person who's otherwise been compliant, and they've been registering for 7 years, and they've never missed anything. And if I'm a defense attorney, I'm going to say in my closing arguments, I'm going to say, well, here we are. Unfortunately, this case has been brought before, and I consider it to be a great waste of the taxpayers' resources, and it's a waste of your time, and I'm sorry you had to take the day off work to be here and to sit through this, and I hope that this will be a quick deliberation, because clearly my client has been compliant, has never sought to evade compliance, and they simply took the action of not coming in because of public health concerns. My client is 62 years old. He has a compromised immune system. He didn't report in because of the advice of the health authorities. And ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I would ask you to return a very quick not guilty verdict. And that's what you'd be likely to get.
I feel you on that one. The part, I try to find situations in the world where you have two essentially impossible choices, and this would be one of them, where you are told by law to go do your registration thing. The police say, yes, you have to come in and register. You are then imposing upon yourself willfully that you could get infected with something that would kill you, or choice B, stay home, violate the law, and potentially get convicted and go back to prison for some undetermined amount of time. That is literally two impossible choices.
That is a difficult choice. I don't see it as being quite that dire. I would not ever advise anyone, if the Douglas County Sheriff is saying come in or else, I'm not going to countermand that, since I can't save you if yeah. you were to be arrested. But I'm telling you, the likelihood of a conviction would be very, very low in view of all that's going on.
Go ahead.
But see, this is something that hasn't been prepared. This would be where you would have the difference between Gorsuch and Scalia, and you would have the intent of the law versus the black letter law. If you put this before Gorsuch or Scalia, they'd say, well, you are a person, aren't you? Yes. You are required to register every 90 days? Yes. You did not go in within 90 days, did you? No. Is there an exigent circumstances and some statutory schemes? They are. They say if there's a natural disaster or something, that there's an excusal for inability to comply. Well, the legislature did not put in this case. Maybe they did in Nebraska. Maybe they didn't. I haven't looked at the statute. But if they didn't put anything in there, the Gorsuch or the Scalia would say, well, if they had wanted that, they would have said that. And the best way for me to get them to put that in there is for me to find the person guilty, because if they want an exception, they should put that in there. We're not here in our black robes to write in those exceptions. And then you would have the Stephen Breyer, who looks at the intent of the law. Well, the intent of the law, of course, is to have people comply. And a person who's complying all throughout their required compliance period, and they willfully don't, non-compliance is not willful, you'd have to say, well, that's not the intent of the law. Of course, we wouldn't want to find this person guilty, and they would overturn the conviction. So I guess you'd have to decide whether you're a textualist or whether you believe in intent. And it's what Scalia refers to as purposivism.
Yeah, that's we need to actually like put a push pin in this particular situation of the intent versus, because I mean, you know, Gorsuch said that the dude should have stayed with the truck and potentially die freezing to death. That like, hey, that's what this means. I would be more inclined. Like, who was going to think of in 2019 we're going to have this? Literally, it's the third pandemic in our recorded history that we know of like this. And under these circumstances, that you would be forced to register or forced to catch the disease, all that stuff. Like, somebody should, you couldn't plan that ahead.
Well, as I was saying, you wouldn't even draft, not even the most detailed bill drafter would not say, well, now wait a minute, now pandemics, what do we do? Okay, well, let's see, we went to the last one, 1918. Oh, well, okay, well, let's plan for the next pandemic. That would not go, just like the visitations. You know, sex offenders are convinced the people required to register. What's that guy say? What's the term we're supposed to use for those who are required to register?
People forced to register is what I thought it was.
The PFRs, right? The people, when they're crafting the laws, they're not sitting around saying, oh, now what do we do with the PFRs that might want to visit our state? I mean, that never comes up.
But on the flip
discussion.
Side, Larry, that's why legislation has 7,000 pages. And did you read it? No, I didn't read all 7,000 pages because there was some bullshit section on some pandemic. When is there going to ever be a pandemic?
Right. So there's no discussion about PFRs. When they wrote their law in Nebraska, no one raised the issue, apparently, about what to do in an emergency. Nebraska doesn't typically have a lot of hurricanes, and the weather-related events would be tornadic and probably snow that you would have that would disrupt people's lives. And they're pretty well equipped for dealing with snow and tornadoes. You have to adjust as they come. But no one ever thought of it.
The closing paragraph of this particular article says, our advice to registered people is, you must abide by this stupid law. For the duration of this pandemic, take a large quantity of disinfectant with you when you go check in and use it liberally in your surrounding to keep yourself from getting infected at the sheriff's office.
I'm not going to say I disagree with that advice if the sheriff's office has said that. But what I would be doing if I were Nebraskans unafraid, I would be going to the prosecutor's office. I'd be going to the Douglas County District Attorney or Douglas County Prosecutor, whatever they call it, and I'd be asking them to proclaim they will not prosecute anyone who has otherwise been compliant. Now, I'm not talking about a person who's been off the grid, like the guy who moved from Colorado and got himself into a barroom brawl and he hadn't registered. I'm not talking about him. I'm talking about people who have been willingly compliant and who are non-compliant for this duration of this pandemic. That's the only people I'm talking about. And if you could get the Douglas County Prosecutor to say they're not going to prosecute, it makes no difference what the sheriff says. The sheriff can say you come in or else and you can do anything you want to, but if the prosecutor's not going to move forward, he can't do anything without the prosecutor's office.
Moving over to an article from The Hill. This one was submitted by one of our super patron type folks, and it's from The Hill. And DOJ appeals to Congress for new emergency powers amid pandemic. This got put in super late in our show prep stuff, and you had to do a speed read on it. And you had some kind of horrifying ideas of these different provisions that they're trying to ask for.
Well, I'm going to take a political tone, which I guess is my prerogative to do, and I'm going to draw some analogies here, which we did in pre-show banter. If this is accurate, and when we put an article in here, sometimes we have to go with the source, and The Hill is saying that the Department of Justice, now the U.S. Department of Justice, is under the direct control of the president. The attorney general runs the Department of Justice, and the attorney general serves at the pleasure of the president. So anytime the Department of Justice asks for something, we're assuming that the president is okay with that request, because the president would simply say, we're asking for what did you say we want? I don't think so. Oh, you'll withdraw that request. So I'm assuming that this has been blessed by the president, or at least by the vice president, or by high-level administration officials. And what scares me is what is being sought in the request. Some of it does seems relatively benign, about judges being able to stop proceedings during a national emergency. But in addition, the DOJ has asked the ability to ask chief judges to permanently detain an individual without trial during emergencies. That's scary. Okay, who would we detain? An individual? Which individual? Accused of what? What would the standard of detention be? And would there be an appeal process for those people? Or would we just lock them up and forget about it?
Isn't that a Guantanamo Bay kind of scenario?
So that scares me. That's kind of a domestic Guantanamo Bay. And another proposal would reportedly waived the statute of limitations for criminal investigations as well as civil trials during an emergency, and could last up to an additional year following the end of the national emergency. Now, that's scary, and I don't know that you can do that for the states. The states that still have statutes of limitations, which they're evaporating in view of all the Me Too movement, but that certainly at the federal level, you could toll the statute of limitations, and that's very scary to me. Now, as I said pre-show, this is the small government people. This administration that's in power said, as previous conservative administrations have said, that they're about reducing the size of government and the power of government. And as they did in 2001 when they created the passed the Patriot Act, which requires every financial institution to spy on you and do all these massive amounts of reports and tracking of your transactions, to creating the Transportation Security Administration, which gropes and fondles even 8-9-year-old kids and 70- and 80-year-old women, and runs you through an X-ray machine that shows your junk, although they do block it out, and I have to give them credit. But they run you through a scanning machine that shows your junk. You know, this is, and charge you $5.60 when that used to be in private hands. This is also the small government mentality that created the Department of Homeland Security, which does all these porn investigations and provides massive amounts of resources to help local law enforcement do what really should be local law enforcement. So this is coming from a small government side of the political spectrum. And it seems to be a dramatic expansion of government, potentially, if it passes. And I would say that since it's being sought by the administration, assuming this is true, that it likely will not have significant opposition in the Senate. It may encounter some in the House, but there again, if you oppose these type of things, then they hold up the patriot card and they say you're not a patriotic American. They question your patriotism like they did the people who opposed some of the measures after 9/11. You know, the FISA court and all the things that we had to, that we've given up, and you of our privacy. Those who opposed that were labeled as unpatriotic, and it was politically almost impossible to fight against that. That's what worries me about this crisis. This crisis may lead to further erosion of our basic due process rights, which nothing more fundamental is to know what you're charged with and have the right to be released and not be held indefinitely. And this is scary stuff.
This is also the people that are all about some originalism and the text and being constitutional, and you have a right to know your charges and all that stuff, don't you?
Well, you would think so, but like I say, I think it's time for you to play Lester here, because this is a little bit of,
he says, what is it he hypocrisy. Says? Here we go.
For you to come back and call beggars my admirers is a farce. It's an act of hypocrisy. It's a terrible way to treat a guest on your show, and you know it.
Well, there you go. There's some hypocrisy from Lester. You do know that if that were on a record, like an actual vinyl record, but by the time we finish this podcast, that thing would be worn out and be all grainy sounding. You remember those days? Do you remember
it
those days
be.
Where you'd wear out a record?
I sure do. I played New Kid in Town. A friend lent me an album. I couldn't find it on single, and I liked that song so much by the Eagles. when I gave it back to him, he said, why did you screw up my track? I said, which one? He told me exactly which one I screwed
up. So you lifted up the needle that many times and played that one track enough that time many times to wear it out?
Well, he had a much better, he was into sound system, so he had a much better stereo system than I had. But apparently I played it enough times that he could detect the scratching on his, when he played it on his stereo.
Back in the day, Larry, I had a little, almost like a shoe shine brush, but it was specifically for records, and you had some spray, and you'd like spray the vinyl, and then you'd wipe off all the dust, and you put it back in the sleeve, and you know, you put it on the shelf. Like, that's back in the day.
Yeah, well, the records are coming back. People are buying vinyl again. I don't understand why, but they are.
They say there's some sort of special sound to it, and I've never, ever been able to figure that one out. Never, ever, ever. Well, let's move over to an article from AL.com. Alabama.com. Alabama judge orders jail inmates released, then leaves it up to the sheriff's. So at first he said they were going to release everybody that had, you know, lower-end charges, but then said, oh, well, I guess we'll leave it up to the local sheriff's to. This is something, you know, we've been kind of hitting on throughout the show tonight. That if you have minor charges, you know, I'm going to go back to felony jaywalking, Larry. And, you know, so maybe you shouldn't be held in detention. Just like, okay, fine, you're getting charged, you're getting booked, and then go home.
Well, unfortunately, Elmore County Sheriff Bill Franklin doesn't agree. And he said that it would be poor policy, public policy, to release some inmates with bonds as low as $5,000. He said examples would be sex offenders who do not have an approved residence and people waiting on a probate court hearing for mental health issues. Okay, so I'm going to substitute. It would be PFRs rather than sex offenders. So let's change that. It would be PFRs who don't have an approved residence. And what I'm struggling with on that is does it mean if a PFR in Alabama doesn't have approved a residence, do they get locked up? Like when their prison sentence, say your time is ended in the state, you're through it at the state level for your conviction. Do they lock you up in a local jail if you don't have an approved residence? Or I'm not clear on what that means. And why would you have a bond anyway? But this sheriff is grandstanding and using PFRs
or people that have mental health issues. And
most of the time on those holds, you really don't have a bond. So when we have a mental health hold, you generally can't bond out. The reason why they have that hold on you is because you're deemed too risky to help. You're either going to hurt yourself or you're going to hurt somebody.
Very bizarre, Larry. Very bizarre that we would have. I don't get the idea of putting someone inside that enclosed container with potentially all the other sick people. You could be the sick person that is now infecting the population. I know you should have thought about that, blah, 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 whatever, bullshit. Like, can we change the rules just for a little while? Probably like 6 weeks, 2 months, maybe 3 months. Can we just change the way we think for a little while?
Well, apparently the circuit judge that made the order, issued the order, did, but he didn't. In Alabama, he's probably a little gun shy about being too aggressive because judges are elected in Alabama.
Judge Persky situation coming, perhaps.
You got to be careful when you're usurping. The sheriffs are elected, as well, and you don't want a sheriff running against a judge, not running for the judge's office, but campaigning against the judge that I'm trying to protect you, and that liberal judge up there in Birmingham issued this order. And I'm going to have to let people out, and you ain't going to be safe, and it ain't my fault. So I'm encouraging you to vote against him come November. How's that for a Southern drawl?
That's deep Southern right there, man. That's deep, deep, deep Southern. Perhaps we should then move over to an article from the Shreveport Times. Chief Raymond announces changes in police complex operations in response to COVID-19. And this is some other place that is making it so that they are not going to lock up people. I'm sorry, this is going to be like registration. The Detective Bureau is open on a limited basis. Sex offender registration is suspended for about 3 weeks from now, I guess. Don't just show up at the office, call in for appointments. If you need help, obviously call them and so forth. But like, people are shutting down, and they are at least like considering the people forced to register in their their scheduling?
Well, NARSL did put out a press release later last week, this week, or whatever we look at. We put out a press release a few days ago. And we're hoping that more and more law enforcement will follow behind and announce similar changes. But even if they don't care anything about the PFR, they have to care about their personnel and their families. And since we don't know who's carrying this, unless you're going to put all your people in protective gear, you really need to just be selfish and shut down for your own reason, for your own selfish purposes. But I would like to think that there's some good people in law enforcement out there, and that everybody doesn't have such a such a cavalier attitude toward those forced to register. In fact, I know there's some good people out there because I hear the stories. I hear stories on a regular basis about how professionally some departments process these. Now, there are a whole lot that don't, but there are some good people out there. This may be one of the good ones. Hopefully it is.
Thinking back to when I was first released, and I lived in a hotel for a period of time, and I want to say it was because the officer was lazy, but you know, maybe he had different reasons. He would not come upstairs. So he would call me from his car, and I would like poke my head out, and we would just talk over the phone for, you know, 10 or 30 seconds, whatever, like everything okay, interaction with law enforcement, alcohol, anything like that. And then he'd move on. You could totally handle all of your, if your statutes provide for that. I guess certain states could be, hey, you are required to go into the office. Whereas mine, they happen to say that they're going to come to me, but they could do it from their car and they could call me. And even if we're standing just, you know, from my door to their car, we could conduct the quote unquote interview through glass, essentially.
Well, but see, there again, your state doesn't require, to my knowledge, last time I looked at the statute, that they go out. It only requires that you come in.
They changed that a handful of years ago. This is something. You don't go to the office anymore. They come out. Yes.
Is that right? So do they bring their fingerprinting?
No, I'm not talking about registration. Okay. I always blend the two together, Larry. I always blend the two. I'm talking about handlers coming out and doing their monthly checks for supervision.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about registration.
I always get them. I just always blend them together. I know that they're separate, but I just always do.
So, okay. Well, in terms of the registration, they're suspending in-person registration, and that's what NARSL called on to do. We're assuming that the probation people are going to protect themselves because there's no law that requires that you visit a PO on a certain schedule. They set their own schedule, so they're free to change their own schedules. But there are statutory requirements that require as frequently as weekly that people go into a physical location. And that's what Chief Raymond has suspended, and he's put in protocols that make it clear that not only is he suspending the in-person visits for sex offender registration, but also almost all in-person visits to the law enforcement. They're running a skeletal operation encouraging people to use the phones. The old-fashioned phone, Andy, can you imagine that?
I don't even know what to do, man. I don't ever pick up the phone and dial anybody, ever.
I've noticed.
Like, send me a text message.
Andy called me one time back in, I think it was in 2017.
I called you back this morning.
Yeah, but it was in response. But you've initiated one call since we've known each other.
I did skip the NARSL article talking about that press release. Was there anything else about the press release? I just want to make sure that we have it because it's in the show notes for anybody that wants to cover it.
Well, I'm very pleased that we got that out there. I don't think that people are going to tremble in their boots and all of a sudden. But what we do hope it does is it provokes thought. And we hope that enterprising reporters, even if they don't call us, that they call the law enforcement and say, really? Are you still requiring these people come? Are you not concerned about the health and well-being of your deputies and their families? We're hoping that it provokes more people to do what Chief Raymond has done. And that will alleviate and ameliorate the concerns on our constituents, because there are people out there who are just terrified that if they don't go in, that something bad's going to happen. And there's no way that we can guarantee them absolutely that it won't.
Can you tell me what kind of impact these press releases and communications do? I was having a conversation with one of our listeners earlier about, I don't know if it was about this, but it was something similar about, you know, what's it going to do if you just throw this thing out there? We oppose this thing. Like, who's going to listen? Does anybody give a flip? And my point back was, so we should do nothing in return. What would you suggest we do instead of? So Can you elaborate on that part of that?
Well, you don't do a press release thinking you're going to change the world. You do a press release trying to get information. When General Motors releases their quarterly earnings and their announcement of their dividend, they don't think it's going to change the world, but they think it's going to empower people, particularly if they announced a very good quarter and if they announced an increase in the quarterly dividend. Well, when we put out a press release, we don't think that the world is going to magically change. But what we do think is going to happen is that more and more journalists are going to become familiar, because as more and more of our press releases hit newsrooms, they say, well, gee, this has become a regular. We've seen more and more of this outfit, and somebody in some of their downtime, they go and do a little Googling and figure out what Narsil's all about. And then as they see more and more of our press releases, hopefully some of these people call they're having a slack day and they need something to work on, and they call the sheriff and they call the police chief and say, what's your reaction to this, to figure out if they can get a story to run with. So you never know. It's hard to measure the impact of this. We don't know how many people have been called that where the press release went out. Now, we know there's a tremendous amount of activity in newsrooms right now. So we know that there's a lot of background chatter. So our stuff, since we're not as well known, probably would not get the same urgency that something came from the CDC. But on the other hand, the way it was, you try to draw attention by the subject line, and hopefully someone has benefited from this, but we can't tell you who. We can tell you that's the purpose of a news release, is to get more information out, get more public discourse, and hopefully get a change of attitudes.
I do understand. I do want to point out that we had a couple other articles describing the same thing. One of them is from, I guess, Sioux County Daily News. I don't even know where did that end up coming from, but Sioux County Sheriff's Office in Orange City. They have closed their business office. All in-person sex offender registry and related issues are suspended indefinitely. That's a long time, Larry.
Well, I looked over this one, but this is also good news that until further notice, you don't have to go in. Now, we're going to have people that are going to still try to go in. They either won't know about this or they won't trust it. And if you feel like you must go in, do something that PFRs have traditionally been hesitant to do: document everything. Document the date, either by old-fashioned hand, pencil and paper, or with your camera phone. Document that they've got a padlock on the door. Document that any signage that they have, and do everything you can to make that risk of going to this office worth your while. And if you do go and successfully register, then we'd actually like to hear about that. Who's still conducting registry? Because we'd like to blast them public for conducting this when it's just not an essential function. So document, right. Document,
and
then, document.
Another one from Dallas Police Department. They are, where does it say, they will be asked to confirm their information, but then instructed to call and make an appointment to come back at a later date. So they're essentially, it would seem that they're essentially shutting down as well in Dallas.
So, but hopefully the positive change that comes out of this, again, if nothing bad happens, hopefully some of the elected public officials, particularly with our suggestion, look, we went on a 3-month hiatus and we didn't have any in-person verifications and nothing bad happened.
That would be, God, does then that stick? Like, we have this window. We have a natural experiment where this stuff was put on hold in these specific places and the world didn't explode. So can't that just become the norm for the rest of the world for policy? But
the problem is there is going to be, when you have anywhere from 750,000 to more out there roaming the streets in the PFR population, someone on any given day is committing a sex offense. If you were to look at the nationwide, I would be surprised if a PFR didn't commit a sex offense daily, because the recidivism rate is somewhere in the 1-3% range. So if you take 2% of 750,000 and extrapolate that down, mathematician, how many sex offenses is that?
A lot.
All right. Well, then there's probably a sex offense occurring daily. So someone is going, during this hiatus, someone is going to commit a sex offense that's required to register. And that's going to be vilified and sensationalized. Well, if they had been coming in, this wouldn't have happened. This is what happens when you don't monitor those kind of people.
I do understand what you're saying. So someone's going to use it for some sort of political points, or the news media is going to use it to get ratings. But the truth being, it makes no flipping difference.
it makes no difference. They would have committed the offense anyway, had they not gone in, or had they gone in, it wouldn't have made any difference. There will be reoffense by people forced to register. They don't magically all never offend again. That's why people have more than one conviction in some cases.
Yes, of course, because they couldn't hold themselves back. Are you ready to close out the show? I have a little special treat if you are.
Well, let's see. Do we have anything we didn't cover?
As far as I know, we do not.
All righty. Well, then what about the 160 people that are in chat?
There are a bunch of
any
people.
Any questions?
No one has asked any questions. I do want to absolutely thank all of, because there's a whole slew. I know you are at home tonight, too, so don't give me any crap. Oh, I was busy. I was out partying with all my friends. No, you were not. You were at home because we're all on lockdown. Like, all of us are on lockdown. But I do want to thank each and every one of you for coming and joining us in chat. But I have something special that I came across on my show prep stuff. Larry, have you heard of a actor, comedian, musician named Steve Martin?
Who is that?
Oh, my God. I can't even fathom. Have you heard of a movie called The Jerk?
The what?
Oh, God, I give up. So there's this guy, been around since the 70s, I believe, and his name is Steve Martin, and he has kind of moved off of his comedian career, and he's a musician. He's a pretty strong banjo player, and he just posted on something on Twitter of just 60 seconds of banjo just to make you happy. So here is Steve Martin and some banjo. We can close out the show while this plays, Larry. I don't know that anybody wants to hear some banjo, because I actually like this. I have a Pandora station that is based on Steve Martin and his banjo.
I like my good night sleep tight a whole lot better.
No, this is significantly better, Larry. Come on now.
Well, we'll let the people be the judge of that.
All right. Well, where can people find the podcast, Larry? What's the website?
registrymatters.co.
And our phone bill is probably going to become due, and we don't have the income to pay for it, so that's going to get shut off. But if you use it, what's the phone number?
Oh, that would be 747-227-4477.
And how about emailing?
And we haven't had enough email recently either. registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
And of course, the best way for you to support the podcast, to keep us going here, is to go where, Larry?
patreon.com/registrymatters.
I so very much appreciate your time, Larry. I appreciate everybody in chat. I appreciate everybody that's out there listening. I deeply, deeply hope that you practice everything that you can to be safe, and that you stay safe, and I hope we all get through this just fine and everything comes out great on the other side.
Thank you. Good night, Andy.
Take care, guys. Bye-bye.